for it to enjoy us the same.
Thanks, Danny.
Well, I'm going to, first of all, have to totally resist just responding to what Danny has said and stick to my given topic, at least at the beginning. I'm going to do a little deep dive here into the federal, the U.S. regulatory system. So, both Jade and Danny have touched on it. And Jade brought up the seminal report, which started it all, which is that HEW report back in the 70s. As an academic, which is the area that I came from before I took my current job, I found it fascinating to read that original report because it's still, a lot of the information in there is still very valid today. And that was a long time ago. It was in the 70s. Coming from that report, one of the first statutes that was written for privacy in the United States was the Privacy Act itself, which regulates how the federal government treats its information. I think this is important, Danny, and you can disagree with me on this, because what I've heard often is in the United States, one of the differences between culture in the United States and Europe is in some ways in the United States people fear their government more than they fear what's happening with their data in the commercial world. So one of the first steps that was taken was to protect the information that the federal government actually had in its hand. And it, the Privacy Act does incorporate many of those OECD principles. So that regulates whenever the federal government collects information on its citizens, the Privacy Act comes into play. So there's one big piece of the picture because the federal government actually collects a lot of data. That will probably not come as any surprise to most of you at the moment. In addition to that really keeping your own house in order piece of this, when the federal government has looked at changing the structure of things or changing commerce in certain areas, it often also seeks to put privacy and sometimes security on as that information becomes more widely available. So some examples of that would be in the financial industry. When a Graham-Leach-Bliley Act was drafted and allowed much more interaction between banks and other financial service industries, there were some limitations put in place on how those industries could share information. And I'm going to use this to segue into a response to one of the things Danny said. One of the reasons they did that is because there is a very strong belief among many people that limiting access to information, whether you think that's doable or not anymore, it has been seen as one of the ways to protect people because it's very difficult to prove after the fact that somebody denied you a mortgage or denied you a job based on information that they had about you. There are, for instance, also some privacy limitations in the Americans with Disabilities Act, where employers can't ask people for information about their health except in very limited circumstances. So you can see that there's a little bit of an idea here that one of the ways that you could limit harm to people was by denying access to the information up front. Now, that may or may not still be legitimate, but it is one of the underpinnings, I think, of many of our laws. Some of the other areas where you'll see some of this very sector-specific approach, of course, are in education. There's FERPA, and I can't remember if it's federal education. I can't even remember what that Records Protection Act, I think. And then the one that I'm most involved in, which is the protection of health information. Now, many people think the protection of health information, oh, it's health information, it's protected under HIPAA. Everybody gets those little notices when you go to the doctor. You know, everybody knows, you know, kind of knows what HIPAA is. But what they don't realize is that even that information is limited. The protection of health information is very limited. That also comes from something that I think it's important for us to understand, which is many of these laws, as a very practical matter, they're statutes. They're written by Congress. How are statutes written in Congress? By different committees. Every committee has a different area of jurisdiction. So you, when you have a statute come out, it's usually kind of limited to what is in that committee's jurisdiction. So when you see HIPAA, for example, it applies directly to what they call covered entities, healthcare providers, health plans, and these things called healthcare clearinghouses that none of you really need to know about. They just make the claims system work. But, you know, everybody thinks everybody who does health information is subject to those rules, and that's not true. For example, I'll give you a great example. People are doing a lot of things on the internet because they think it protects their privacy more. Yet the people who have healthcare sites on the internet who don't do any health insurance, they're not even covered by HIPAA. They may come under the FTC jurisdiction. It depends on what they say on the front. So you can see that there are a lot of there are jurisdictional issues. There are lots of siloed regulations. Yet they're no longer so siloed, and that's one of the issues we face with big data. Is because those strong parameters that may have been in place in a paper world are ceasing to exist. It's all very blurry. So we've regulated in the United States traditionally on sector. Now, there's a big mush over between health information and financial information even at this point. And education information, all of those are, the figures are blurry. We have regulated in ways that protect our citizens, and not necessarily when you read these statutes, not necessarily citizens of other countries, depending on what it is. So, and now you have all that information is being combined in one place, and the parameters are very difficult to draw. I would also say that. We have the discussion to date has on this panel has pretty much focused on the data holders. And in the United States, we have a whole series of laws, most of those that we've just discussed, like FERPA, the health, financial sector. They all say, you hold the data. These are the purposes that you can share it with another entity for. But there's also a very major set of rules in the United States called the Common Rule that apply to researchers and who are funded by the federal government or who are supported by the federal government. And those rules are somewhat different than the financial and the health sector, the data holder rules. They use different definitions. So what is a defining point in almost every privacy law is right now they all protect identifiable information. Now, what does that mean now? It's a very good question. Now, the HIPAA privacy rule, which governs health, has a very prescriptive definition of what is de-identified information. It has a safe harbor. If you take these 18 identifiers off, we know there's some risk out there. They calculated the risk. They don't think it's that high. At least it wasn't when they first came up with those. If you do that, you're good to go. You get the same information on the flip side of that equation where it goes over to a researcher. The definition of what is identifiable information under the Common Rule is different. So those are things that are pretty important to keep in mind as you're going forward and you're looking at big data. It's all going to be combined. How are you going to be able to actually parse all these different rules out and accommodate them? There are a couple points here that I'd like to make because I've been involved in some National Academy Science projects in the past, which have had very lofty goals. And I think lofty goals are good, but also practical ones are also very important in order to make a real difference. Statutes are very hard to change. That's not saying that you shouldn't do it or you shouldn't look at that direction, but particularly when you look at Congress these days, getting a statute passed is an extremely difficult measure. Regulations take a lot of time also. But they are more flexible, and they're the area where there is most flexibility is in guidance or the way you can interpret existing law. for short-term goals. So there's a long-term regulatory approach and a much shorter-term regulatory approach. You can see some of those things as leading you to on a guide path of where you might want things to be, very much so in the future. One of the things that we are really faced with in this whole area as we're looking at that glide path is that most individuals in the United States right now have a very different understanding of how their data is held and where it is flowing than the people who are professionals in this area do. And so you have this gap between expectations and reality. I say this as a cautionary note because, and I want to give one brief example of that. In Texas, for years, they collected blood samples from a number of, from newborns. And the general public was not aware of this. And it's not like there was any nefarious intent or anything. A lot of research, records research, is done kind of, I would call it under the radar. It's done with approval by IRBs. If not, they don't obtain individual consent. It's difficult to do. But the general public isn't aware of this. So when they find out something like this, like they did in Texas, they sued, and they ended up destroying thousands and thousands and thousands of really, you know, very beneficial data. So it's also important when you're looking at the regulatory approach in the United States is not just what the rules say, what Congress might say, what the regulators might say, but what will the public citizens say, and how can you involve them in any process up front to mitigate a potential negative backlash in the future? Thank you.